Thanks. I'm glad someone noticed that article, that we a three-generation article. That was a lot of fun. My son, well, I'm a fourth-generation attorney, and I have two uncles and a brother who are attorneys. And my son, who's Leland Stanford McCullough the fourth, hasn't quite decided what he's going to do yet, but he's got a little pressure from genetics, I think. He may end up as an attorney. Well, we'll go ahead and get started, and I thought what I would do today is go through some relatively recent court cases having to do with asset protection and just tell the story behind these cases, and hopefully some of the characters in the stories will be of interest, and we can pull out a few points we can learn from in asset protection planning. Before I do, I thought, why would people in this audience be interested in asset protection planning? I think most of you are not giving legal advice for a living. But you're probably involved in a lot of planning where clients are interested in asset protection planning. And so hopefully some of these principles will be of interest and we'll answer some questions for you. And I'll certainly leave time for questions at the end. So the first principle I want to talk about, see if I can make this work. Well, I can turn it off. Let's see if I can. I know. There we go. First principle I want to talk about is asset protection using separate property ownership. So this is one of the oldest and most basic ways to accomplish it, asset protection. This is where a husband and wife either sign a prenuptial agreement before they get married, or after they get married, they sign an agreement that says he's going to own his property separately and she's going to own her property separately. And separate property ownership is something that's not going to go away. It's always going to be there. It's possible, as far as I know, in all 50 states. Even in a state like California that's a community property state, and we think, oh, everything they own is community, it's statutorily possible in California to sign an agreement called a transmutation agreement where husband and wife own property separately. So this is something that works everywhere. It works very effectively in the right situation. It has some limitations, but it's easy. It can be done very inexpensively. It involves almost no ongoing maintenance. It involves very little risk of attack on alter ego grounds. It's pretty easy to avoid fraudulent transfer when we make transfers between husband and wife. So it's got a lot of advantages. You probably all know people who put the home in one spouse's name who they think is less likely to be sued. They don't go hire a lawyer to do trusts. They don't pay a lot of money and do anything fancy. They just put assets in the name of the safe spouse. If there's one spouse, it's less likely to be sued. And in many cases, that is effective. I think that it's important that you go one step further and you sign an agreement between husband and wife saying we intend to own our property separately, and anything titled in his name is his property and anything in her name is her property. Without an agreement, you know, it could be argued that you never really established separate property ownership. One of you was just happened to be available on the day the home was purchased and it was titled in their name, but both have rights to it. So I think it's important to have an agreement. In this first case that I'm going to talk about, they did have an agreement. This is called Lakeside Lumber Products versus Evans. It's a 2005 case, so it's by far the oldest case I'm going to go over today because these are supposed to be current cases and updates. But there are no updates to this case that I've seen, and I don't think there will be many because the principles are so old and so basic it's not likely to be litigated very often. So the facts of this case, Dan and Renee Evans set up a trust, and it was a joint trust. And so rather than a trust for husband and a trust for wife, this was a Evans family trust that they both shared. But in the trust language, it said that within the Evans family trust, there's going to be a trust for Renee that will hold her separate property, and there'll be a trust for Dan that will hold his separate property. And it was very clear in the trust agreement that anything that got titled into Renee's trust was her separate property. So they set up this trust. They titled the home into Renee's separate trust. So it's clear that they've established separate property ownership. At the time they did that, he had plenty of assets in his name or his trust as well. And there were no claims against them. They were perfectly solvent. This wasn't a situation where they were trying to hide or protect assets at the last minute. This was just a typical couple saying, let's create separate property ownership in case we run into something in the future. So they did that. 3 or 4 years later, his company asked him to personally guarantee some of the debts because they needed a personal guarantee in order to get a loan, so he did that. A couple years later, the company started to struggle. It went into bankruptcy. He was sued on those debts. He went into personal bankruptcy. He had no assets, and so the issue became, can the creditors of Lakeside Lumber Products go after the home that Dan was living in, which had been titled in his wife's separate name for a long, long time? And the appeals court looked at it, and they said that it was her separate property, that it was not a fraudulent transfer when it was transferred from him to her. And even if it had been a fraudulent transfer, the statute of limitations had run. So Utah has a 4-year statute of limitations on fraudulent transfers. So even if he had made a fraudulent transfer to her, 4 years later, you're barred from trying to go after the asset on those grounds. And then the plaintiff tried a creative argument, and they said, we think the creditor should be able to get the home because the home is really in a constructive trust for Dan. Even though it says it's Renee's separate property, the trust says if she dies, it goes back to Dan. And he's been a co-trustee. And so we think we're going to call this a constructive trust for Dan. Even though it doesn't say it's a trust for Dan, that's really the effect of it. And they tried to make that argument, and the court said no. And the creditors were not able to reach the home. And so that is that's a case involving separate property ownership. Now I'll quickly tell you a case that I've been through in recent years that's very similar to that, just to give you another example. So I had 4 business owners come to me. They owned a business that did marketing, and it was making millions of dollars when they came to me. They were very successful, and they all wanted to do estate planning for their individual families. And so I met with each family, and 2 of the families, we did this kind of a plan where we put some assets in the husband's name and some we put in the wife's name. The other 2, we did a different kind of asset protection plan where the wife put, or the husband put certain assets in an irrevocable trust for his wife. We call that a third-party trust, and we'll get to that later. But they set up this plan at a time when they were perfectly solvent. There were no claims against them. They were making a lot of money. And they left the business in the husband's name because he worked in the business. And they put the home and the savings and the investments and the brokerage accounts in the wife's trust. And we did not believe that was a fraudulent transfer because when you think about it, he ended up with more value than she did in that transfer because the company was worth a lot more than the other assets. So you can't argue that he made a transfer for less than adequate consideration when we divided the assets and he ended up with more. So I felt very good at the time. This is not a fraudulent transfer. There are no claims. They're perfectly solvent. And he came out with more value than she did. So we put that plan in place. A few years went by, and their company was struggling a little bit. And so they took out a $13 million loan from a group that had a lot of cash. And it turned out that group was a Ponzi scheme, and a lot of people were losing money. Now, my clients didn't do anything wrong. They just borrowed money from this Ponzi scheme. But as their company continued to struggle and do worse, and they were unable to pay that back, the receiver who was appointed to collect all the money from the Ponzi scheme and try to reimburse all the people who lost money investing in the Ponzi scheme, they were assigned to go after everywhere that money went out of that Ponzi scheme. And one of the places that money went was a $13 million loan to my clients that had never been repaid. So they sued my 4 clients and tried to go after them and collect $13 million. Fortunately, once again, this was more than 4 years after the estate plan had been done where assets had been put into the wife's trust or the irrevocable trust. And so no one could even argue it was a fraudulent transfer. Like I said, I don't think it was, and we would have won, but they were barred from bringing that argument. But they still wanted to find a way to attack and do the best they could. So they did a lot of discovery, and we disclosed every detail. We gave them copies of the trust. We gave them all the assets that were in the trust. And there were a lot of assets that would have been nice for the receiver to collect and give to the people who lost money. And the receiver looked at everything and determined that he would not be able to collect from any of those trusts and ended up settling with them for a few $1,000s of cash that were left in their basically bankrupt business and going away. So it was a real success. And these 4 clients felt like the asset protection plan that we put in place using separate property ownership was a very successful plan. So you're already starting to notice some principles. One principle is, the earlier you do the planning and the more time between the planning and the time things go bad is the biggest single factor in every asset protection case. In my opinion, no matter what theories they use to go after assets, that is the single biggest factor. And in most of the successful cases, the planning was done well in advance. You'll see that come up over and over. So I think that is all I have to say about asset protection using separate property ownership, unless someone has a question. Any? Great. Yeah, I think there's a very strong argument in Utah that if a husband earns the money and titles assets in his wife's name without any more of a clear agreement that it's meant to be her separate property, that it's not separate property. Well, there's no question. There's no question in Utah that a husband has a right to make gifts to his wife that are meant to be her separate property, or vice versa. There's no question that a couple has a right to agree to own property separately. And there's a specific statute in Utah that says one spouse is not liable for the debts and obligations. Let's see. It says the separate property uses that important phrase. The separate property of one spouse is not liable for the debts and obligations of the other spouse in Utah. So it's very clear that if you're able to establish separate property, that you can't go after the separate property of one spouse for the debts of the other one. That is crystal clear by statute. What's not clear is how you establish separate property ownership. I think if you do it by agreement, you're home free. You're home free. Anything short of a written agreement that specifically says this is meant to be separate property is a gray area. As far as I know, it hasn't been litigated, and nobody knows the answer to that.
Okay. So the second question that I have, followed up with that, is that several years ago, there was a law passed for asset protection trust, and everybody was hot about the Alaska Trust at the time. And the failures that I saw in the asset protection trust, which seemed to come through, was the fact that they couldn't cover financial institutions outside the state of
That's a great question, and I'm going to cover it in a little more detail in a minute with some court cases. So I'll answer it more thoroughly in a minute, but just to give you an answer, I agree with your assessment that one weakness of a domestic asset protection trust, or specifically a Utah domestic asset protection trust, is that if you're sued in a state other than Utah, and that state's law is determined to control, that there is precedent now that a creditor can reach those assets, even if the trust was properly set up, properly funded, done in advance. I think there's precedence, which I'll show you in a little bit. So that is a potential weakness. And I don't think it's a weakness that the state of Utah, in their legislation, can do anything about, because it's a choice of law issue.
Well, then, how is it that the Alaskan trust can be more powerful than providing the asset protection?
I believe the same principle applies, whether it's an Alaska trust, a Nevada trust, a Utah trust. And again, I'll show you the precedent and how I get to that conclusion. Great questions. Terrific. So let's move on to the next one. Asset protection using a self-settled domestic asset. Oh, that's the one you asked about. So you didn't have to wait long. There are three cases that I know of that involve this new concept of a domestic asset protection trust. And let me back up and explain what the concept is. Okay, here's the background. For 150 years in our country, the principle was, in all 50 states and in bankruptcy, if you set up a trust for yourself, creditors can reach the maximum amount that could be distributed to you. So if you set up a trust for yourself, it's not protected. It's not going to work. That's always been the public policy. It's always been the law everywhere in this country. And then in the 70s and 80s, some offshore jurisdictions passed a law that said you can set up a trust in our jurisdiction for yourself, and it's protected from creditors. So some U.S. residents would go to the Cook Islands and some of these other offshore places, and they'd set up a trust under their law that allows a self-settled trust to be protected. Then in 1998, Alaska was the first U.S. state to pass that type of law, and quickly Nevada followed, and now we have at least 13, maybe a couple others have joined. It's at least 13 states have passed a domestic asset protection trust law that allows you to set up a trust for yourself and have it still be protected from your creditors. The other states are still under the same common law that's been around forever, that if you set up a trust for yourself, it's not protected. And so now we run into this choice of law issue. If I'm sued in Utah and we have a law that says it's protected and it's in Utah court, then probably it's going to be respected and it's going to be protected. If I'm sued in a different state, no one knew what would happen until some of these recent cases. So there's two cases. One's called Mortenson and one's called Huber. I'm going to talk more about Huber, but they're very similar, actually. Both Mortenson and Huber were a Washington resident who was trying to protect Washington assets using an Alaska Asset Protection Trust. So in the Huber case, he was a real estate developer and very successful, had a lot of assets. And then in one of the downturns of the real estate economy, things were looking ugly, that they had as many liabilities as they had assets, and they started getting nervous. And he had a dispute with his partner, and his partner said, go ahead and sue me. I'm going to put everything I have in an asset protection trust. And Huber said to his partner, if you do that, it'll be a fraudulent transfer, and I'm coming after everything you have. And they had this little fight. I don't know how this came out later, but it came out. So then Huber got to thinking, maybe I ought to protect my assets. And they found an attorney there in Washington and who told them about this Alaska Asset Protection Trust. And they set up an Alaska Asset Protection Trust and transferred almost all of his assets to it. And it was at a time when there were financial clouds hanging over him. It's hard to say whether he was insolvent at that point, but he had a lot of people, debts he couldn't pay, and a lot of worries, and maybe more debts than assets, depending on how you value things. So at a time when there was threat and concern, he transferred almost every asset he had into an Alaska Asset Protection Trust. And he appointed Alaska USA Trust Company as trustee, and he paid them a nominal fee. I don't remember exactly what it was, $2,500 a year or something like that, $3,000 a year to be the trustee. And Alaska USA Trust Company did almost nothing. They didn't keep books and records. They didn't know what assets were in the trust. They didn't sign tax returns. They had $10,000 in a CD that they were the trustee and the signer on, and that was all they did. So Huber went into bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy court looked at this, whether they could go after the assets of this trust, and they found that the trust failed on several grounds. And it's important to note that as you read the court case, it failed on each of these independently. So it would have failed under any of these grounds. But the first one's the most interesting to me. The first one was the choice of law issue. And they analyzed it and they said, Washington law applies to this. He's a Washington resident. Almost all the assets are in Washington. And the lawsuit's in Washington. Creditors are coming after him in Washington court. And it's a bankruptcy case which defers to state law, which is Washington law. So they determined Washington law applied, and under the public policy of the state of Washington, creditors can reach the maximum amount that could be distributed to the grantor of the trust. And so they said that the creditors could reach the assets of the trust under Washington law. And that's independent of whether it was a fraudulent transfer, an alter ego, or any of the other ways you can attack a trust. And so that's precedent now on the books that other courts could use. So it's my belief based on that, that if you get sued in California, a Utah Domestic Asset Protection Trust may not hold up. And, you know, under the Huber case, that would be the precedent they'd use. Yeah?
So they sometimes, these trusts are used to isolate assets from estate taxes. I transfer, the trust grows in value, I die, it's not treated as part of my taxable estate because I'm a discretionary beneficiary. If it fails for asset protection, does it fail for estate tax protection?
I'm amazed at the brilliant questions. I mean, that is a brilliant question. And there is the estate tax laws pertaining to these irrevocable trusts do say that if creditors can reach it, then it's in your estate. That is one of the statutory ways that it's included in your estate. And so no one knows for sure. There haven't been IRS rulings or tax court cases or anything yet where the IRS tried to include assets of an irrevocable state based on of an irrevocable trust based on the fact that under certain states, creditors could reach that. So we don't know for sure, but there's certainly a threat that you could argue that if some creditors can reach it, then it's in your estate and it's not going to be effective. So I think there's a risk there. If you're using an irrevocable domestic self-settled asset protection trust, thinking that it's out of your estate, I think it's a gray area. I think it's a little bit aggressive. That's also why a lot of people analyze the different states and they say, well, Alaska law is better than Nevada or Nevada is better than Utah and vice versa, because some states like Utah have carve-outs and they say certain creditors can reach it. It's protected from some kinds of creditors, but some creditors can reach it. And so if some creditors can reach it, does that make it in your estate under the estate tax laws? I think there's an argument that it does. Yeah. Yeah, that used to be the theory that if I am a creditor and I get a charging order against your LLC interest, that I'm going to have to pay I get the K-1 and I have to pay the taxes every year even though there's no distributions. And I believe that has been settled by a revenue ruling. Everyone I know in the industry believes that this certain revenue ruling, and I can't cite it for you now, but I could get it for you afterwards, indicates that, I can't remember the terminology, but a charging order on an interest is not enough to give them the K-1. The K-1 still goes to the member. Now, if they foreclose and become the owner of that interest, then maybe they do get the K-1 at some point. And I can't remember what the terminology is. It's something about you've got to have control or vote or something over that interest. So if it's just a charging order, it's probably not good enough. So that was the prevailing theory of use LLCs and family partnerships for asset protection because they get a K-1, they have to pay the tax, but they don't get any money. I don't believe that works anymore. Again, a great question. Okay, where are we at? Okay, so domestic asset protection trust. I told you there were three cases. The Mortenson and the Huber case, the domestic asset protection trust failed. The creditor was able to reach the asset. And in both cases, there was plenty of language to establish precedent that they can reach it because it's a self-settled trust under the wrong state's laws, not just for the other reasons. Now, those trusts would have failed for other reasons in addition. I believe in Huber, it was found to be a fraudulent transfer, and it was also found, or maybe they said, we don't have to analyze the alter ego issue because it's already failed under these other two. We're not even going to analyze that. So in both of those two cases, the domestic asset protection trust failed. There is one case where you can argue that it succeeded, but nobody ever talks about this case. And I think it's because the court didn't analyze this issue of, is the domestic asset protection trust effective? The case was won on the fraudulent transfer issue. So in this one, it's called Trust Co. And see if I can remember the facts well enough. But a lady on the East Coast set up a Delaware domestic asset protection trust, and she transferred some assets to it. And she had loans and guarantees with some big banks that she was obligated on, and she went and told them, I just transferred some assets, so my balance sheet has changed. Here's my updated financial statement. So she disclosed the fact that she'd made a transfer, which you could argue might have been a fraudulent transfer. And by disclosing that, it started the statute of limitations running. She was still current on her payments. It's just she was letting her creditors know, I made a transfer. And they didn't do anything because she was current on her payments. So 6 years went by, which was the statute of limitations pertaining to this case. I believe it was a New York statute of limitations. 6 years went by, and she failed to make payments, and they sued and came after her, and she couldn't pay. and they could not go after these transfers she made to Delaware Domestic Asset Protection Trust because the statute of limitations had run. So that case was lost on the fraudulent transfer issue, and nobody ever really made the argument whether it should fail because these are domestic asset protection trusts. That argument never was made, so we don't know how it would have came out. So it's not really great precedent, but it was a case that actually succeeded for the debtor trying to have asset protection because she did it in advance. Well, she let them know 6 years before anyone tried to collect. Mark. Good point. Yes. In the Huber case, they mentioned that because we're in bankruptcy, it's not just a 4 or 6 year statute, it's a 10 year statute. And they did find it to be a fraudulent transfer. I believe that they were still within Washington's fraudulent transfer time as well, but they did refer to that and certainly said it applied, and so that was an important part of it. And so one of the downsides of a domestic asset protection trust, self-settled domestic asset protection trust, is that in bankruptcy you have a 10-year statute, where outside of bankruptcy it may be a shorter statute. So that is all I have to say on the Domestic Asset Protection Trust. And I don't mean to be overly negative. I know a lot of people in this state think they're the greatest thing since sliced bread. But one way you could look at it, if you want to be negative, is there have only been 2 cases and they both failed. Yeah.
You've had a lot of brilliant questions. This one's probably a stupid one. I'm here because I don't know a lot about trust. What does it mean, self-settled?
Okay. Self-settled means you're creating a trust for your own benefit. And that's an important distinction, because I'm going to go on in a minute and talk about third-party trust, where you set up a trust for someone else's benefit. So going back to the history I went over earlier, the law in the United States for 200 years has always been, if you set up a trust for yourself, there's no asset protection. And that we call that a self-settled trust. But if you set up a trust for the benefit of your wife and children or your other family members, that's not self-settled, so none of these rules apply. So everything we're talking about here on these new types of trusts that have only been around since 1998 wouldn't apply if it's set up for someone else. Yeah. Right.
This may be a little bit of a tangent, but I've got a couple clients in pretty ugly divorces right now.
Right.
How does that work in a divorce where you've signed over these assets into your spouse's name?
Now you've joined the Brilliant Question Club, so nice work, nice work. And I should have mentioned that.
50-50, that's pretty good.
So I've had hundreds of clients get a divorce with every one of these types of plans. I've had 100 clients with separate ownership go through divorce and with irrevocable trust and with domestic asset protection trust. And so I think I've seen that many, many, many times. And my belief and experience is that in a divorce judge has the power to make sure it's an equitable property settlement. Now, equitable is usually 50-50, but not always. Maybe they've been married a short time and one person brought more in. So equitable may not be 50-50, but it usually is, especially if they've been married a long time. And so, for example, if a couple wants to protect their assets and they put most everything in the safe spouse's name and the other spouse has his business and it struggles and goes bankrupt and he has nothing, in a divorce, I think the assets that they have at the time of divorce are going to be divided 50-50. And I can give you all kinds of crazy examples where you wouldn't think it would be that way. I have a number where the husband puts all the assets, almost all the assets, in irrevocable trust for the wife. He's not a beneficiary. It's not his asset. He's given it away. If he gets sued or goes bankrupt, his creditors cannot reach it. Then they get divorced, and we have an irrevocable trust we can't amend, and it's for the wife's benefit only. And he's thinking, oh, no, I'm left out in the cold. No, I've seen a million times a divorce judge say anything that ever comes out of that trust has to be divided 50-50 because he's got her, and she's a beneficiary, and he can give an order that says anything that comes out of that trust has to be divided 50-50. So I've seen that. So I'm very confident that divorce judges have the power and authority and the wisdom to make sure there's an equitable division, no matter what we've done for asset protection planning. Did that answer the question?
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And will that depend on the date of the prenup as before the agreement or after the agreement?
Well, I'm not sure of the distinction between the prenup and the agreement. The prenup is the agreement. The prenup says we own our property separately.
Oh, so you're saying that the agreement then is going to take the place of the prenup, and I'm suggesting that there's a prenup for a divorce, but that you're separately doing the living trust, putting it over in the wife's property.
Yeah.
The head of some big corporation making lots of money, you know.
Yeah.
Agreement.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think an attorney's got to be careful here. When you're doing a prenup, if their objective is to own property separately and have it be upheld in a divorce, then you're going to write that in the prenup. In the event of divorce, we each keep our own separate property. But it's also possible to do a separate property agreement that says we own our property separately, but we're not saying what happens in the event of divorce.
But in the prenup, though, normally you would also say, or you might say, well, if you're with me this long, then you get so much of alimony. If you're with me this long, you get more alimony. And so
yeah, and prenups are enforceable in Utah. If they're, yeah, if a prenup is done correctly, they're enforceable in Utah. I'm very confident with prenuptial agreements.
I'm not saying that they're not enforceable. I'm just saying, is it going to interfere with the separate strategy? Because it seems like they could be at odds if you've got the prenup here saying one thing, and over here you've got the living trust and the agreement for the living trust, and all of a sudden it goes to court, the prenup comes out, which counters some of what the agreement said.
Yeah, I mean, you'd just never set it up that way. You'd never have an agreement say something different than the prenup, I guess you can always update a prenup, but whatever the latest valid agreement is between husband and wife, you know, can be effective in divorce if it's done correctly. Yeah, you could update a prenup. We do that from time to time. We do postmarital agreements. So forgive me if I've made this confusing, but what I'm trying to say is an attorney can draft an agreement between husband and wife that is enforceable in the event of divorce so that they come out with separate assets and everything's not divided 50-50. That can be done. Or an attorney can draft an agreement between a husband and wife that gives them separate property ownership, which is effective for asset protection, but doesn't say what happens in the event of divorce and leaves it to an equitable division by a judge. So we can get the best of both worlds. We can find out what people want. We can get the best of both worlds. Okay, let's move on to offshore trusts. It's an interesting world with offshore trusts. You have attorneys throughout the country with very different opinions, very strong opinions on whether offshore trusts are effective or not. And I have my own bias, and I'll share it with you. And there are attorneys out there who think that I'm wrong, and I think that I'm right. And so I'll just tell you up front, take it for what it's worth. But I believe that there is a string of 30 or more cases in the United States in the last 25 years where courts have been able to severely limit the effectiveness of an offshore trust. And I list all those on my website, and I try to tell the world, you know, if you're selling offshore trusts like they work every time and it's guaranteed and it's the greatest thing in the world, and you're totally ignoring this string of cases, I think you're either not being honest, you're not being fair, because there is a lot of precedent out there for what courts can do to try to go after offshore trusts. And so what this string of cases I'm talking about basically say is that in many cases, a court will say, you've put your assets offshore. I recognize that I don't have authority to command the Cook Island Trust Company to return your assets. They won't listen to a U.S. court order. So I can't get your assets. But I have you. You're still here. You're in my courtroom. So I order you to repatriate the assets in the offshore trust or go to jail for contempt of court. And there's a lot of precedent for that. It's happened, and the people who sell them They never mention it at all, or if they do, they'll say it happened once or twice in a bad facts case. Well, there's a lot of cases where it's happened, and I think it's important to at least acknowledge that, that it's a possibility that a court can say you're ordered to bring the assets back onshore, and if you don't, you go to jail. And there's one case where a guy sat in jail for 7 years because he wasn't willing to bring them back, and we got cases where they've been in jail for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years. And sometimes the court gives up, and they say, my order to jail you has not been effective in persuading you to bring the assets back, and we're going to let you out of jail, because a contempt order is not supposed to be punitive. It's only supposed to be coercive or persuasive, and it's failed. So some people have sat in jail long enough to have the judge say, this is no longer persuasive. It's just punitive. We're going to let you out of jail. And others have just coughed up the money to get out of jail. Now I admit that it's rare that a court will go to the extent of saying, bring back the money or I'm putting you in jail. But it does happen, and it happens enough that I think people should be aware of it when they go into an offshore trust. The other limitations of an offshore trust are, we pretty much know they're not effective at protecting U.S. assets. There have been enough...
How long is long enough? I'm sorry, but I'm
sitting in jail, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, at least one case, it was 7 years before they let him out. And there have been some where it's been 2 or 3 or 5 years. So it depends on the judge and how he likes you and that sort of thing. But for me, one night in jail is enough. I'm coughing up the money. You know, I don't think I'd want to go there. And so I think in advising a client to do an offshore trust, you should at least be aware that one of the downsides of it is it may not work if a judge decides to use contempt of court to get you to cough up the money. Another downside of an offshore trust is it's not effective at protecting U.S. assets. There have been a number of cases where there's real estate here in the U.S. They put it in a family partnership. They put the family partnership in a Cook Islands trust, and they say, our assets are in the Cook Islands, so they're protected. And a judge says, no, the real estate's sitting here in Connecticut, and so I'm going to give an order for that real estate to be sold at a sheriff's sale. And I can do that because it's physically here, and they sell the real estate, and the offshore trust meant nothing. So I'm quite confident the offshore trusts are not effective at protecting U.S. assets. So now, for most clients, they have homes, they have stocks and bonds, they have bank accounts in the U.S., and they're not willing to move everything offshore just to have asset protection. So that's a serious limitation of an offshore trust. In this case, SEC versus Greenberg, I just mentioned that one because that one's a 2000. Is it 15 or 16? I believe it's 16. It's a very recent case where a man was sent to jail, contempt of court, for failing to repatriate assets from an offshore trust. So I've got cases going back from 1992 through 2016, and so that concept is alive and well. And then the U.S. v. Grant case is much more interesting, so I'll give you a lot more details on that. So there's a Mr. and Mrs. Grant. I don't remember the first names. I'll just call them Mr. and Mrs. Grant. And they put millions of dollars in a couple different offshore trusts. And then Mr. Grant got behind on taxes, and the IRS came after him to collect. And in the midst of that process, he passed away. So now they're trying to go after Mrs. Grant for those taxes because they always filed jointly, so they're both liable. And she says, I can't get the money from the offshore. I've written a letter to the trustee. Here's a copy of the letter. I've asked them to send me the money to pay the taxes, and they won't send it. So the offshore trustee is doing what they're hired to do, right? They know this is set up for asset protection. We're not going to give her money right now because the IRS is coming after her. So the plan is working as it should in the Grant's view. So she tells the court, I can't get the money. So the court looks at this issue of, shall we hold her in contempt of court? Because we think she can get the money. Obviously, they wouldn't have put millions of dollars somewhere. They couldn't get it. We don't believe that. So they looked at whether they should hold her in contempt of court. The IRS petitioned. They asked the court to hold her in contempt. And the court said, we're not going to do that because we think she's tried to get the assets and she can't. She never had anything to do with setting up the trusts. We think she's an innocent person here that can't get the money. We believe her when she says, I can't get it. We're not going to hold her in contempt. So when that came out, everyone who sells offshore trusts declared a victory. And Grant was the big case that was used to say offshore trusts work and you don't have to worry about being held in contempt of court. Well, a few years went by and Mrs. Grant needed money to live on. And the trustee of the offshore trust said, well, we're not going to distribute money to you because there's a court order that says any money you ever get from that offshore trust, you've got to pay to the IRS. So we'll distribute it to your kids. So the offshore trust distributed money to her kids, and then they would give small amounts to her under the table, and it would appear in her bank account, and she had money to live on. This went on for a few years to the tune of $221,000. So then the IRS said, well, it's been a few years. Let's do discovery again and see if Mrs. Grant is getting any money. And they saw she is getting money. It's coming from her kids. So they did discovery on her kids' bank accounts, and they said it's coming from the offshore trusts. So we know what's going on here. So they went back to the court, and they petitioned that she be held in contempt again and that the court make an order because she's playing games and she really can benefit from this money. And so the court issued a very interesting order. And it's very broad, and it says, I might just read some of the points to you. I'll just tell you. Well, it says, she is ordered to request every quarter money from the offshore trust and report to the court that she's made that request or she's going to go to jail. She's ordered to repatriate the funds, and if she ever gets any funds the rest of her life, to turn it over to the IRS. And her kids, all of her children, are ordered by the court to turn over any money they ever get from the trust for the rest of their lives to the IRS. So now we have this very interesting situation where the Grants have protected their assets, but they and their children can never benefit from those offshore assets. I guess they could always move. If you move to Switzerland, then you can benefit from those assets because you're outside the jurisdiction of a U.S. court. But you want to be on the run the rest of your life from the U.S. government. And so I think the Grant case is a very interesting case to show the power of the U.S. courts. If you're trying to use a self-settled offshore asset protection trust, you're basically saying, I know the law says I have to pay you, but I've hidden my money and I'm not going to. Where these other techniques, the law says they can't reach the assets. And so we're abiding by the law. We're using the law to protect assets appropriately, and it's being upheld by the law. The offshore is trying to hide it from the law. And I think courts, that U.S. Grant case gives future courts precedent to issue orders like that one. And so I'm down on offshore trusts, but I know there's those who disagree. Any questions on the offshore trusts? They're also very expensive, a lot of ongoing costs, a lot of IRS reporting requirements. You could be in a situation with the offshore trust where you're required to pay the taxes on all the growth on those assets because a U.S. person has to pay tax on all their worldwide income, wherever it's at, and all the income of an offshore trust, wherever it's at. You're required to pay the taxes, but you can't get any money out of it because there's a judgment against you. So you could be in a really negative situation with an offshore trust.
Do the Mark Rich
What's that?
Mark Rich. Fled to Sweden.
Right. Yeah. And that's a good point. So one way the offshore trusts are effective is if you're willing to move yourself offshore in addition to your money, then it'll probably work. Okay. Wonder how I'm doing on time here. So this is my personal favorite, and again, it's my bias. It's 3:30. Does anyone know, am I doing okay on time? I think I'll go 10 more and you can leave if you want to. I wouldn't blame you. Okay, so I'll move a little quicker here. A third-party spendthrift trust is where, for example, I would set up a trust for my wife and kids. I'm not a beneficiary of it, so it's not a self-settled trust. So it works in all 50 states in the bankruptcy courts, unlike a self-settled trust, which only works in certain states under certain conditions. So I've set up a trust for other people. I can't revoke it. So if I can't get it, neither can my creditors. It's a spendthrift trust, which makes it so the creditors of the beneficiaries can't get to it either. So it's protected if my wife gets sued or if I get sued. This is better than the separate property ownership because separate property ownership won't work very well if the safe spouse happens to get sued. They could get in an accident, or we could have IRS problems. We both file joint returns, and so the safe spouse is just as liable as I am. So in the Grant's case, if they had done separate property ownership, it wouldn't have worked because they're both liable. Offshore trust is not working very well. But if they had done this, it would have worked really well. If the husband had just said, I'm going to set aside some assets for my wife and kids to make sure they're always provided for no matter what, and put them in this type of a trust, it'd be protected from his creditors because it's irrevocable. He can't revoke it. It's protected from their creditors because it's a spendthrift trust, which is accepted in all 50 states. And the money would have been protected, and the trust could have provided for Mrs. Grant. The beauty of a spendthrift trust is not only can I distribute money to the beneficiaries, but I could buy a home and let the beneficiaries live in it. I could buy assets for their use. I could pay off their debts. I can provide all kinds of indirect benefits. If I don't want to make a distribution to them because they have creditors, I can pay their tuition at school. I can pay their landlord directly. So a trustee of a spendthrift trust can take care of the beneficiaries in many creative ways, and Mrs. Grant would have been much, much better off with a regular old onshore third-party spendthrift trust. So quickly, I'll just mention these cases because I know we don't have a lot of time. The first one is where a husband and wife set up a Cupert. This is an estate planning trust where you're trying to get a valuable home out of the estate. This was a $5 million home. They put it in a Cupert, which is a trust for the kids eventually. They have the right to live there for 23 years. If they die during the 23 years, it's still included in their estate. If they live beyond the 23 years, they've got a $5 million home out of their estate. So they accomplish their estate planning objective. This is interesting because husband and wife set up this Cupert, and they are the trustees. So they retained control over the trust. They ended up going into bankruptcy, and the court looked at it to say, can the bankruptcy court go after this home, which is in the Cupert trust? And the bankruptcy court determined they cannot reach the home. Even though husband and wife are the trustees, the trust is being operated correctly. So it's not their alter ego. So a lot of people say you can't put your spouse as a trustee, you can't put a family member as a trustee. That's not true. There's no law that says a related trustee means they can pierce a trust. As long as the trustee is operating the trust correctly, and in this case, husband and wife are not the ultimate beneficiaries, the bankruptcy court, which is, you know, has a lot of power, was not able to reach the home. So Yerushalmi is a relatively recent case upholding this idea of a third-party irrevocable trust. The other one I'll tell you real quickly is U.S. v. Kimball on the bottom of this list. This is this year, came out like 2 months ago, in June 24th. Here, Kimball put a bunch of assets in irrevocable trust for his kids. And he's the trustee of that trust, but it's not for his benefit. It's only for the benefit of his kids. The IRS came after Kimball because he got in some tax problem. They have a $1 million tax lien. They couldn't collect against him. And so this case was to determine whether the IRS could collect against this trust. And it was determined that they could not collect against it because it wasn't a fraudulent transfer when it went in. There's no facts that would make it look like his alter ego. So here we have a really solid case where we have a great creditor like the IRS that can't get to the assets because of the effectiveness of a third-party spendthrift trust.
How many years is the statute of limitations on
that? In Utah, it's 4 years. Good question. And then quickly, let me tell you about Badger and Wisden. These are also this year. In the Badger case, George Badger put a bunch of assets in corporations, trusts, limited liability companies that were in kids' names. He wasn't the owner. The kids were the owner. The wife was the owner, this and that. But he was using the assets as if they were his. He was taking money out of them, living on it. He was living in homes that were owned by a corporation, owned by his kids. He was acting like it was his assets. And so the Tenth Circuit, for the first time, announced that reverse veil piercing is now a tool that's available in Utah. So let me explain that in English. Veil piercing is where you sue a corporation and the creditor wants to pierce through the corporate veil and go after the shareholders. That's been available forever in Utah. If you can show that the corporation's being run like the alter ego of the shareholder, they're commingling funds, the corporation's not adequately funded, they're not treating it like a separate entity, they're not keeping minutes, they're not doing all the things you should do to show a corporation separate. It's always been the law that creditors of a corporation can pierce and go after the shareholders. But it's never been established in Utah whether someone that has a claim against a shareholder can pierce up into the corporation. And this case in Badger, the Tenth Circuit, which is our covers Utah, said reverse veil piercing is a valid theory. And so if you have an entity, I don't care if it's a trust or a corporation or an LLC, and you're not running it like a separate entity, you're acting like it's your own, you're living in the home that it owns without paying rent, you're taking money out of it as if it's yours, then your personal creditors can pierce and get the assets of that entity. And it's interesting because that includes trusts as well as corporations and anything else. So that's now precedent in Utah. And within a couple of days, or right about the same time, the Utah Supreme Court came out in an entirely different case with the same holding. This is the Wisen case. The Utah Supreme Court held that reverse veil piercing is available in Utah, and it applies to trust just like it does corporations. So I've told you that I think this third-party irrevocable spendthrift trust is the, in my opinion, the strongest way to protect assets. But even then, if you are acting like they're your assets, you're commingling funds, you're living in it without paying rent, you're not complying with the formalities of the trust, then this theory could be used to pierce the trust. So not only do we need the right theory and we need the right drafting, we've got to make sure it's operated correctly afterwards. So I give all my clients, when I do a trust for them, I give them operating instructions. And I say, you got to follow these operating instructions if you want this to be upheld the way you think it's going to be. And I think that's a critical part of it. And so the keys are, you have to do your planning in advance before there's a problem. You got to pick the right strategy. You got to operate it correctly. And then I think we're about out of time, but I will really quickly, I'll just mention that certain assets are exempt from creditors just because the statute in Utah says they are. That would include life insurance. It would include IRAs and retirement plans. And it also includes, at the bottom there, one handgun and ammunition not exceeding 1,000 rounds, one shotgun and ammunition not exceeding 1,000 rounds, one shoulder arm and ammunition. So the old-fashioned method of asset protection still seems to be available. So. Thank you. Thanks for coming.